Hello, and welcome to Vanguard Audiobooks, The Learning College. I'm Alex Linder. I'll be your host as we go through 5.1 to 5.10, 5.01 to 5.10 of James Mason's Siege. You can find this and everything we record at vnnforum.com and later permanently archived at alexlinder.com. Siege was compiled from newsletters put out by Mason from 1980 to 1986. Chapter 5 is called The System, and it begins with several epigraphs. The first is from 60s Jew radical Jerry Rubin. And he says, quote, "In your living room, you're scared shitless, and that's just where the power structure wants you. In the middle of a riot, I've never found anybody who's chicken shit. The way to eliminate fear is to do what you're most afraid of. The way to eliminate fear is to do what you're most afraid of." Jerry Rubin, again, a Jew, 60s radical. Next up is a quote from Captain Gerhard Rossbach of the Berlin SA. And remember, the Sturmabteilung was originally the detachment for the protection of meeting halls, because the communists in Red Berlin, just as they do today, tried to no-platform Hitler. They didn't want him to use his free speech under Weimar law to talk to the Germans about what was really going on. Goebbels was sent to Berlin, and he did change it from red to brown, the Nazi color. So Captain Gerhard Rossbach of the Berlin SA says, quote, "The abscess on the sick body of the nation must be cut open and squeezed until clear red blood flows. And the blood must be left to flow for a good long time, till the body is purified. So cut the vein open, let the Jew putrefying liquid run out until there's nothing but good, honest, red German blood remaining." So says Captain Gerhard Rossbach of the Berlin SA. Next is a quote from the writer Vladimir Bukovsky. Quote, "This dream of absolute universal equality is amazing, terrifying, and inhuman. And the moment it captures people's minds, the result is mountains of corpses and rivers of blood." Again, Vladimir Bukovsky. Finally, a quote from someone I'm not familiar with, named Edwin Reynolds. Quote, "What is legal? Legal is anything that the system does. Legal is whatever the system allows to happen. Illegal is whatever the system does not allow others outside the clone system to do. The system is legal, therefore legal is simply the system." Those are the epigraphs to Chapter 5, titled The System. 5.1, The Way Times Have Changed. The Way Times Have Changed. Says James Mason, "I can't think of a more stark example of the way things have turned around just within the past 20 years in this country than something uttered by Gus Hall in 1961. Now, some of you younger people, Gus Hall was the president of the Communist Party of the USA. So this is going to be something that he said that's actually a twist on something French revolutionaries said back in the 1700s, and he's saying this in 1961, before Kennedy was assassinated, which was kind of the turning point, I would say, in America. I think that's at least it's as good as any other to call a turning point. Gus Hall, again, president of the Communist Party USA, said, quote, "I dream of the hour when the last congressman is strangled to death on the guts of the last preacher." Now, I don't know whether it was Robespierre or another French revolutionary who said he wanted the last king to be strangled with the guts of the last priest. That is what Gus Hall is twisting for his own statement. I'm saying it's not original. It's a take. It's a revised version. Anyway, Mason says, the right wing went crazy over that one and used it as part of their heavy ammunition against the Communist Party. Well, old Gus has shelved that rather embarrassing statement. Not because he is getting soft in his old age, hardly, but rather because it is about as outdated as high-button shoes. In those days, 1961, he may have had some basis for a statement like that, because conservatism and the former concept of America, as it was known, was making its last stand against the total subversion that today holds all the seats of open power. Today's congressmen and preachers are truly among Gus Hall's best troops. Why, he wouldn't want to harm a hair on their heads. Gus and his buddies have it all. The Congress and the clergy are two arms on the body of Big Brother. Conservatism lost, while the forces that Gus Hall was running with won. And so now the shoe is on the other foot. Masters of subtlety, they've everything except signs posted on the walls to the effect that Big Brother rules completely. But our movement has no corner on profits. The words of Gus Hall, too, will ring true yet in the United States, but they will do so in such a manner, with such an ironic twist, that he and all his fellow travelers will choke on them. And that was Volume 9, Number 7, November 1980. Whose society? It remains altogether impossible to refrain from encountering conservative sentiments, reactions, and other modes of thought and behavior. There remain great numbers of those short-sighted ones who feel that the situation can and should be, quote, cleaned up. The fact is that this kind of thinking plays directly into the hands of Big Brother's lackeys who are trying desperately to hold their system together as long as possible, to suck as much blood as they can out of the dwindling number of productive Americans before it all finally goes to hell. The answers they propose for the totally insane and out-of-control crime rate are, number one, build more prisons, but mainly, number two, the death penalty. Fry 'em, say the reactionaries. They envision the ghetto criminals and rapists, etc., going straight to the hot seat, but that is a dangerous delusion. Few are aware that one of the first men to die as a result of the renewed death penalty was John Spenkelink of Florida, who was a white man, a National Socialist, whose, quote, crime was having killed a homosexual who had made advances on his person. There is a case of a National Socialist who voted in a state election for an issue to deny bond for certain violent crimes, only to be arrested himself and charged with just such a crime, and, since the issue passed, denied bond. What of Joseph Paul Franklin and any of the men who followed in his heroic footsteps, who may one day face the system's, quote, death by injection? You must remember, the system is going to do nothing to fight crime, but only to increase the degree of its hold over every individual. It created the crime wave in the first place as an excuse and a plausible cover for the erection of its police state. And if it can again use the issue of rampant crime to get you to agree with a death penalty, only to turn right around and use it on you and other white revolutionaries? We want to see crime and chaos rise to such a degree where the system becomes no longer viable and falls apart. We want to see them lose control, not increase it. We want to hasten the death of the system, not postpone it. The liberal do-gooders, so hated by conservative advocates of the death penalty, saved the life of Charles Manson and those of his circle who had been condemned to die in California's gas chamber after the conservative Nixon had declared them guilty in national headlines. What of such favorite conservative issues as universal military service? They want a strong U.S. military, but they are so ignorant of history that they are unaware that the U.S. has never been allowed to fight and defeat an enemy, but only to go and kill other white men, such as in the Civil War and the First and Second World Wars. They appear perfectly happy to go and fight another war to save alien interests. Besides, if you were a young white man or woman, do you wish to be drafted into any of the services alongside the dregs of society and under black officers, possibly to be sent to die in fabricated wars, possibly to be sent, a la Little Rock, to violently suppress your own white brothers and sisters? No, let the military continue to crumble, as it is doing, for it is merely one more instrument of terror and coercion in the hands of the enemy. What other reactionary favorites can we choose from? Drugs? Abortion? Gun control? If we are unable to recruit for our positive purposes from the populace and get them to drop out of service to the system, then we must accept whatever means there may be to cause more of them to fall by the wayside and become useless to Big Brother. The spread of the use of drugs is one of these methods. The increase in abortion is one major symptom of the total collapse of American morality, which is one of the pillars of any society. As long as the alien is in control of the society, let it perish also. If the cowardly reactionaries can fool themselves into believing they are, quote, free by possessing firearms, but lacking the guts to use them, then it would be heartwarming to watch the system pigs strip them of these. Make no mistake, under our society, our laws, crime would be eradicated overnight. Likewise, with the illicit use of drugs and unnatural trends such as abortion. Every man and woman would be militarily trained. Every home in America would be well stocked with defensive weapons. But this would only be in our society, never theirs. And that was Volume 12, Number 1, January 1983. 5.3, Saturation Point. When I was a kid in junior high school, I had one science instructor whom I genuinely admired and respected. He even took my side in crowded corridors when I was verbally assailed by typical smartasses who would attack my, quote, totalitarian beliefs by agreeing with me that democracy and voting were a farce, etc. One theory of his own creation that he offered to the class, and which made an instant and lingering impression on me, was that it required approximately 8 years for the trends prevalent in places like New York, Chicago, and Los Angeles to filter down to places like here, Chillicothe, Ohio. That was 18 years ago, and the theory hasn't missed yet. The worst sort of maladies of the big sinkholes of North America have since well established themselves here. All the horror headlines that used to be only printed in the doomsaying Thunderbolt, and that was Ed Fields's publication out of Georgia, many years a white nationalist newspaper, you now can read every day in the lone paper here in this small town in the Midwest, again, Chillicothe, Ohio. The worst of it all, you name it, and it's here. And what does it mean? It means, scientifically and irrefutably, that the country isn't going, but has gone mad. That the final end of society is accelerating. That the entire foundation itself is thoroughly corroded. And that there is no longer any place to go hide, save maybe a tent in the North Woods. Now, isn't that the most encouraging thing anyone has reported to you in a long, long time? Like a brown bag or a cardboard box full of manure, held aloft with the bottom darkening with saturation from all the slimy, stinking filth contained within, it is up for grabs how many moments or seconds remain before the whole repulsive, putrefying mess comes crashing through. But of course, it hasn't yet, and it's, 30 plus years later from his writing this. And that was Volume 13, Number 7, July 1984. As we move on to page 200 and 5.4, The Poison and the Rot. This may well be the first time ever in history that an entire people cannot sustain itself, minus electricity and the things run by it, but it is not the first time that an entire people has been eaten away at its very roots and core, so that no healthy portion large enough remains to carry on with the semblance of the former civilization. It has happened often enough in the past, most notably in the case of ancient Rome. A great many Roman ruins still stand today, such as their aqueducts and viaducts, and are in modern use. But nowhere, not even in the city of Rome, can one find a true Roman, a living specimen of the people who built that culture and that empire. We know in the movement what became of them, but how many can see the parallels as they are happening here today? As it occurred in history, the Dark Ages followed the collapse of Rome. As a number of observers have seen, so far in its history, the United States has not had a revolution, only a war of independence. It has not had a civil war, only a war between the states. Our true revolution and our true civil war are things of the future. They'll probably take place one on top of the other. And our own, quote, fall of Rome and, quote, Dark Ages will most likely overlap as well. Things are moving so much faster nowadays. What's happening to the backbone of the U.S. population, all those millions upon millions of Anglo-Saxons, has been a squeeze play operation from the close of the last century to the present day. Commander Rockwell talked of the, quote, niggerization of American youth, and he was right. But since he was forced to swim in a milieu of conservative rightists, he neglected mentioning the other half of the assault that was just as deadly, that from above. 50 years ago, all of the social ills that have this country by the throat today were confined to two limited areas: the colored ghettos and among the circles of the filthy rich. These people who today are indulging in and or are trapped by this social cancer, from drugs to whatever you want to include, might imagine it is something new. It isn't. It's only relatively new to them. It required several generations to do it, but finally their resistance was broken, and the walls were removed, and hell has risen. And it's referred to them as, quote, freedom, all these in quotes, democracy, equality, progress, self-expression, alternate lifestyles, human rights, dignity, etc. A thousand euphemisms for social decline. Social decline presented as progress. I've said before that it has reached everywhere now, and indeed has stood at that point of saturation for some time. If there ever is to be a major input of the clean, the fresh, and pure to hope to rejuvenate the situation, as in the case of Rome, it'll have to come from the outside. As with the armies of invading, quote, barbarians, that the integrated, soul-rotted Roman legions couldn't resist. That points nowhere but the east, if it can happen before the rot of the west fatally infects the East as well. But in the hopes of getting our own thinking balanced out, could there ever have been a danger to our masses of racially sound people of being poisoned from below unless they had already been rotted from above? Healthy people aren't susceptible to such things as drugs and racial mixing. It took a couple of generations of Hollywood's and New York's effects on their minds via the movies, the newspapers, and especially the television to get them properly softened up. In my book, there's really nothing more vile and detestable than a crowd of so-called beautiful people centered on Los Angeles, New York, and all the really fashionable resort spots, etc. And again, he's writing this long before reality TV promoting this type of crap. These are the types set up by the media to be worshipped and emulated by the masses. Take a look around at the results of 50 years of this. And, just as a final thought, exactly what bunch of people was it that were erased by a few hippies back on a hot night in 1969, and for which Charles Manson now serves several terms of life imprisonment? While we were watching out below, Manson saw the threat from above and acted. Volume 14, number 4, April 1985. Five point five, Lost in Time. Among other things, I happen to be an amateur photographer, and I've been involved for the past few years in documenting the development and decline of this city. The town of Chillicothe, Ohio, was formerly not only the state capital, but also capital of the entire Northwest Territory, which encompassed all of Ohio, Michigan, Indiana, Illinois, Wisconsin, and parts of Minnesota, the Northwest Territory. In short, it has its historical significance. 100 years ago, this place was a hub of commerce and travel. Today I, quote, joke about its future as perhaps the only ghost town east of the Rockies. I've lived here all my life and have seen the population remain static that whole time. I've witnessed firsthand the more rapid and heartbreaking phases of this city's deterioration. Through the photographs I've collected, I see that this was a city of incredible beauty, geographically and architecturally, from about 1800 until the late 1940s. You could say the same thing about, say, Macon, Missouri. Go back and look at old postcards and look at old photographs of the buildings. That's what he's talking about. It was better before 1950 than after. In recent years, the Chamber of Commerce has loudly bemoaned the, quote, dying downtown. Not ghettoized, as they hadn't brought in the Somalis yet like they have in many places of Ohio, particularly Columbus. Just dying. As special as this place is to me, I feel it's most likely not an isolated case. To draw focus on the undeniable slow death of the city's downtown business section, the first thing one has to notice, as cause, is the huge shopping mall built just across the river in the mid-1960s to the north of town, which sprang up like a mushroom, gobbling up acres and acres of prime farm and pasture land and affecting an, quote, arid wilderness of steel and stone. If you have seen one of these, you've seen them all. So much for personality and local charm. Enter the big chains like Sears and out with the local businesses. But the downtown was already in trouble before that mall was built. Why was that when no real competition as yet existed? I found the answer buried deep and out of sight in the dusty files of the Historical Society. Left alone for hours, days, weeks, and months on end, with photographic files unavailable to the public, I was able to totally familiarize myself with the changing face of the city over a period of a century and a half. We won't have the 500-year wait in the United States, as they had in Rome, for advanced decay to wipe away everything of beauty and value. At this rate, it'll be over with easily in another 100 years. Racially, yes, of course, we're all familiar with the statistics on North America. But before we got into hot water racially and genetically, we began letting our architecture slide. As in Egypt, Greece, and Rome, the architecture may be all that's left now. A very few poor, tumble-down wrecks as reminders of a glorious past. But I feel it was probably the same there as well. People stopped giving a damn, and wattle began replacing granite. Cheaper and easier, of course. You can drive down Main Street here and see a marvelous old edifice, a parking lot next to it, then a structural and architectural piece of crap next to that. And the latter two are gaining ground all the time. So, parallel between the architectural design becoming or architectural materials becoming inferior, with the racial stock becoming inferior, but the architecture preceded the racial change. The city is, at this point, thoroughly bastardized architecturally. Nothing fits. There is no harmony. An occasional pet project of the Historical Society will stand out amidst the desolation. But I've seen these streets 100 years ago, when every block, in all directions, was picture perfect, a fairy tale setting, a show place. And I saw it all change. At first, still during the 19th century, when any building was razed or otherwise had to be replaced, a bigger and truly better one went up in its place. Parking lots, of course, were unheard of. The time of the wonderful building stopped at about the time of the First World War. Chillicothe was the site of one of the largest troop training centers in the United States. Camp Sherman was erected in 1917 in a matter of weeks, just north of the city, across the river, opposite the site of the mall I spoke of earlier, contained over 3,000 well-constructed barracks, and then was almost totally eradicated by the end of the 20s. While it existed, it was bigger than the city itself, Camp Sherman, for World War I. It seems that no really decent building went up after the time of the First World War. things got static until the 40s and 50s, when destruction and demolition began to really take their toll. Fires and floods had their effect on original structures, which had been built to stand the centuries. Renovation and the creation of parking space took care of the rest. As for the rolling beauty of the outlying area, condominiums and other such ready-made slums, literally for welfare cases, not to mention superhighways and beltways, have pushed out in all directions. As with the replacements for the great buildings of the 1800s inside the city, these, quote, condos have a serviceable lifespan of approximately 40 years. They are frail, ugly, and inhuman. Now, Chillicothe is in south central Ohio, about maybe 40 miles south of Columbia, just so you know. Furthermore, as I've witnessed it up close quite a few times, the biggest effort when any modern contractor sets about the job of erecting one of these glorified huts is involved in the tearing down of the existing structure. The fact, terrible and terrifying, is that these modern engineers and laborers cannot themselves build the kind of buildings that they have such great difficulty demolishing. For one thing, we today as a nation are too poor to afford to erect such palaces. And worse, the craftsmanship and the materials for it no longer exist. They don't make good brick anymore. But the question I had centered upon was the mystification over the death of the downtown. Also, in these thousands of photographs I've studied, are many interiors of the various stores and shops of the downtown. They resemble the insides of jewelry boxes. Yeah, if you've ever seen those old, like, movie theaters or stages. Specialty shops, family-owned and operated, where people took pride. Local industries producing furniture, automobiles, tires, canned goods, our own dairy, mill, pottery, paper, the only ones still remaining, and everything that was necessary to sustain the town and profit by export to other areas. This city was a major stop along the Ohio and Erie Canal from the 1830s until about 1913, when the canal was finally destroyed by the flood. Today, Chillicothe is as dependent as any other area on trucking, etc., for its basic needs. The marvelous shops were taken over by first one and then another succeeding business, remodeled and refurbished until the effect was one of ugliness. Great tracts of floor were parceled and divided until the effect was that of a bunch of Middle Ages shepherds squatting in the shadows of the pillars of the Parthenon or the Acropolis, from temple to brothel. The 4x8 panel, the drop ceiling, and the interior-exterior carpet, they couldn't keep up the old standards of decor and appearance So it appeared logical to chuck it all and go across the river into virgin territory and build afresh. This is precisely what Eisenhower had advised the Germans to do after the war. Abandon their cities, their culture, their heritage. The Germans didn't take him up on it, but rebuilt everything just as it was before, brick by brick. A classic example of how different peoples handle a lost war and a lost peace. What's the answer? It has to be a matter of bad values or no values at all to have allowed a situation like this to come about within 60 years. And note well, this took place years ahead of any of the more overt signs of racial deterioration. When one is no longer reminded of beauty and worth and order in what he sees around him, naturally he's going to think less of himself, what his mate should be, or what his children should be, if indeed he bothers about children at all. Those without a past seldom worry about a future. Volume 12, Number 10, October 1983. This is the story of Chillicothe, Ohio. Certainly one of the best things we've read so far, in my opinion. 5.6, U.S. cities, : hazardous gene dumps. A cartoon was reproduced in one movement periodical which I receive, depicting a mob of crazed liberals lynching a handgun while the actual robber himself walks away free and unmolested. This is an insight into the prevailing mentality. So it is with the issue of pollution. They go wild on the question of hazardous waste dumps, but are oblivious to the far greater danger of the hazardous genetic dumps, which are our major U.S. cities. Now that deserves to be revised, and I will use that in some of my daily writing. Hazardous genetic dumps. How perfectly does that describe, since he's in Ohio, the importation of Somalis into Ohio? Hazardous genetic dumps, which are our major U.S. cities. So what if we can manage over the next 100 years or so to clean up the vast amounts of garbage and waste that the capitalist system has brought about if, over the same period, we have degenerated into a bunch of low-level savages? A human garbage dump with no chance of reclamation. It is a cornerstone of the National Socialist outlook, and a hard one at that, which so few can manage to grasp, that no matter what, if the blood is preserved pure, it can survive and overcome anything. If atomic warfare destroyed all human life on Earth but two Aryan specimens somewhere in New Zealand, we could begin again. There is no greater threat than that of genetic pollution facing life on this planet. That is the one and only thing that could conceivably erase all civilization, all higher culture, and send this planet, as Hitler said, swirling back into the ether. It is an unnatural, peculiarly human trait that allows so many otherwise intelligent people of our race to look upon inferiors as equals, quote unquote. It is something, a sickness actually, that will most certainly die with the passing of this current age, and hopefully will not take all the rest of us down with it, in line with the priority of the blood kept pure and free of alien genes, When comparing the respective damage to be done by other forms of pollutants, I've often stated that the condition and content of these cities make a positively attractive case for atomic warfare. After all, don't they employ radiation in the treatment of cancer? Then why not atom bombs for demographic cancer? That, of course, is the far side of radicalism. It is, however, intended and offered in a 100% straight and sincere conviction of its inevitability. And so, while we don't discount the prostitution and poisoning of the land, air, and water, we still view the defiling and befouling of the race as the worst possible corruption of nature's highest creation. Who was it that said, "If you would build a better society, build a better man"? Volume 12, number 4, April 1983. Five point seven, the whole is greater than the individual. I'm not a sports fan in any form, but only a blind hermit could fail to be aware that, with regard to boxing, the blacks have gotten and kept that field pretty much to themselves now for several generations. There are also a lot of black football superstars, as well as blacks in the past, having been renowned for their ability to run like all hell. Feet do yo duty. Is this, then, any case for racial equality? Or even black superiority? Don't make me gag. But millions, evidently, are content, even eager, to think so. A comparison with regard to what goes on inside the ring. Take an electric magnetic can opener and take an old model squeeze and twist kind and place both in a cement mixer. Turn on the mixer and let it go for half an hour. Remove both openers and see which is still working. The more primitive, of course. That's about as valid a test of can openers as it is of human beings. The advanced brain and physique of the Aryan wasn't intended and didn't evolve to have the hell pummeled out of it for sport. But if you're going to pit a white man and a black in the ring and call it a match, why not pit a black in the ring with a gorilla? Same logic. Same kind of match. You know who'll win every time. The more primitive. But take an army of blacks versus an equal number of gorillas and see which side wins. The blacks, of course, because of their greater ability to organize themselves. Take an army of whites versus an army of blacks, and the whites will win every time for the same reason. So who, then, is superior? To attack a family of gorillas, which are some of nature's most shy and timid creatures, would be a gross immorality. To attack a village of primitive black Africans, replete with grass skirts and bones in their noses, would be equally unfair. But today, when confronted by armies of vicious black street criminals, outfitted and trained in modern weaponry, and who are out to, quote, kill whitey, the bets are off. When they challenge the white man as a race, they must be answered as a race. It's a very good line to remember. And the answer to any such challenge is a foregone conclusion. Therein lies the main fallacy of democracy, human rights, human dignity, racial equality, and all the rest of the system hogwash. taking people one at a time, you'll get nowhere. In fact, you'll become hopelessly lost. There are plenty who say it isn't fair, but they overlook that the concept of fairness was an invention of, an invention of, and only exists in the mind of the Aryan. The third worlders and internationalists know it's a joke. They are winning because we keep ourselves manacled on bonds of our own making. Ideas and customs intended solely for and amongst our own kind, not aliens. Commander Rockwell loved to repeat the prayer of the non-whites and the early sicko Christians of the post-Roman world when faced by, or whenever contemplating, our Viking ancestors. Quote, Lord, save us from the fury of the men of the north. This time, Lord, screw 'em. That was volume 10, number 10, October 1981. 5.8, Big Brother, the System, and the Establishment. The time is overdue for us to get a few terms and definitions down pat. What we deal in are not simply cue words or catchphrases, but actual functioning people and things that make up the reality of the circumstances we are forced to deal with. The left has been the master of the art of the blurb, of garbage semantics, with their famous ones such as imperialism, racism, and fascism. If any of these things were real, then it is doubtful whether we in the movement would have felt ourselves constrained to declare war on the society as it stands. Indeed, we should feel perfectly at home sharing positions of wealth and power alongside the ruling class, were this the case, which is actually what the modern-day leftists are doing. And so, we do not deal in fable, we deal in fact. In previous segments, we have spoken of the establishment, and many would object right away that we are lifting the term from the new left of the 60s. The establishment is a reality, though concepts of it vary widely, and until a better term comes along, we will stick with its usage when referring to the economic and social goings-on in the nation and the world today. These are your big and little money people who make it possible for this stricken monster, the system, to continue lurching forward yet another step, then another. They buy us time, and yet they condemn us to a longer sentence. Some of them pay pretty good lip service to some of the movement's more conservative aspects, but they do not lend any appreciable support to the movement for the implementation of its program. They like this capitalist system, and only really resent the bigger official capitalists who are ripping off the ripoffs. The establishment is corrupt, complacent, reactionary, and business as usual. The system, capital S, is a term not so frequently used by the left in the past, because to glance at it too closely would reveal that the same ideals are postulated by both, except that the phony revolutionists, in quotes, are in a bigger hurry than are the Kennedy-type establishmentarians. We use the term system in place of the word government because what controls America and the whole West today are not governments. They are faceless tyrannies, branch offices of a single monstrous system. Important point. When we speak of the thousands of interchangeable, expendable parts of the alien, inhuman bureaucracy, we speak of the system. From police to welfare bureaucrats to city, local, state, and national appointees and so-called, quote, elected officials, from prison administration to the armed forces, those who either represent the system or who are in the employ of the system are, in fact, the system itself. High and low, it is marked by the overweening drive to entrench itself ever deeper into the body of the nation, like the parasite that it is, to evade any and all real responsibility and to regulate the lives of everyone it can in as minute detail as the system legislators can clear a, quote, legal path for it to do so. So the goal of the system is to expand and entrench itself in the body of the nation and regulate everybody down to the last atom. When we speak of Big Brother, we use a term which has been infrequently employed by the right wing of years past because traditionally the right has been associated with big government or central government. That's a little confusing. The right has had its share of stock dialogue phrases, not altogether accurate, and tending to fall into the easy manipulation of its very opponents, the liberals, for that reason. The, quote, communist conspiracy, unquote, of the right, for example, has been looking more foolish as the years have gone by. We of the movement are aware that most of this is, in truth, the capitalist conspiracy, of which the communist segment is but a poor relative. So when we use the term Big Brother, we mean, first of all, the conspiracy in general, for have no doubt it is a conspiracy which is at work. We do not harp away on Jews, 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 but this conspiracy is practically unthinkable minus Jewish input and control. We recognize that there is a highly disproportionate degree of Jews in the establishment, the system, and in Big Brother, which their overall population percentage does not justify. But Big Brother is the wellspring from which all the really noxious social, cultural, and economic poisons emanate. It is the alien worldview which now permeates everything consumed by the public. Everything must have Big Brother's seal of approval before it is marketable, printable, believable. It goes far beyond mere liberalism. It contains the greatest amount of drive of any ideology or worldview ever imposed on an unaware or unwilling populace. None of its tenets or programs work in practicality, but no matter. The forces and resources of both the establishment and the system have long ago been harnessed to clamp on the dictates of the Big Brother advocates and their stated goal of total integration and everything that implies. We do, however, subscribe to the old adage that in order to kill an ism, you must kill the ists, the people who carry the bad ideas. It is a general rule that in this ultra-sick society, the members of the establishment, the system, and of Big Brother's exclusive few share many common traits. The most basic of these is cowardice. And from cowardice comes repression. As we have already said, none of them will accept responsibility for anything. Their defense is their endless red tape. Their offense is their economic system, not to mention the press, courts, and police. They hide behind the, quote, law. They are, quote, officialdom. They are the ruling class. If we are to play by their set rules, as we must, then one of them is co-equal to all the rest, as guilty as the next. To participate in this anti-white conspiracy is a crime that shall be punished by death, and no appeals are granted by the Revolutionary Court. Volume 11, Number 6, June 1982. The Simplistic Society. I've been told in recent years that we just can't blow the heads off the powers that be, that we simply cannot call for an anarchy. But what these sensitive, conservative types can't grasp, or refuse to grasp, is that the alternatives are either fast being removed by circumstances themselves, or they are gone already. What we must recall always is the magnificently just and civilized program, with a capital P, which Commander Rockwell offered to the nation and the world during his 9 years as head of the party. No one chose to listen. It's now out of our hands. The point remains that the deadly and worsening situation we each are caught up in has at no time been the product of accident or even of stupidity. In point of fact, were things to be let alone, then a natural process of healing and correction, what Manson would call a balance, would begin to take place. However, this can't happen unless and until the source of the poison is gotten to and shut off, as a prerequisite to any chance for even the most gradual improvement. And for this golden chance of a lifetime reprieve, we could afford easily and happily to do without a majority of what today passes for, quote, indispensable. Indeed, much of it is part of the poison, and we would be far better off without it anyway. Our task is uncomplicated, yet awesome in its individual challenge. I think the entire movement is generally agreed that the system is going to fall. Indeed, it is currently in the process of falling. We have in the recent past the lesson of Iran. When the Big Brother regime there was toppled, all the high technology and the money itself disappeared. Yet, Iran has gone on to successfully purge itself of practically all of its impurities and has fought a victorious war with a militarily well-supplied neighbor. And it is doing so under the direction of one elderly holy man who embodies the spirit and will of the entire nation. Are we to think it can't happen here? But Khomeini's march, stretched over a period of a generation or more, much of it spent in exile. We're no strangers to enduring long, dry spells, made even more oppressive by the iron grip the system has over things in this country. But more is still required. We'll need to have a team ready when the time comes. As some more advanced movement thinkers have already projected, this occurrence may well be on a worldwide scale. Many believe that it is essential it does happen in this way, so as to thoroughly pin down the forces of Big Brother. Everything connected with the past will be erased, and we can begin again minus any alien or renegade influence, minus any parasites. We will have been provided with a clean palate with which to do this. Primitive is not the word to be applied, but rather simplistic, or even organic, because a purely white society is intrinsically far superior to any high technology, mongrelized cesspool such as what exists today. What this will mean will be the beginning of a new golden age for our people. It's volume 11, number 7, July 1982. Finally, we'll move on to the last one for this session. 5.10, business as usual, hyphenated. It is those who are blindly willing to trudge on in the standard accepted fashion of business as usual, and these alone, who permit the system and the establishment to keep functioning. In recent years, they have seen themselves reduced from pawns to victims, and yet nowhere do we see any appreciable trace of popular rebellion, that is, genuine rebellion. They continue to work their jobs, go home or to the bar, drink and watch television. Is it that their resistance has been totally conditioned out, or that obvious channels of resistance are as yet managed by the fellow travelers of the system? Why, for example, have not the communist factions called for a general strike nationwide? This business-as-usual attitude, practically a fanaticism in itself, as it calls for total inaction in the face of the worst excesses and outrages, will be the greatest single thing about the current historic phase that will puzzle and mystify researchers and historians for the rest of time. Quote, "Such miserable swine as these," they will think, "so utterly devoid of the will to live, or even of the worthiness of life itself," end quote. For us today, this prevailing attitude contains the most ominous portents, and it actually gives us the outline of events to come. The peoples of Europe chose to cling to business as usual in their refusal to join with Germany in the defense of Europe. What they got was World War II and the state of affairs that has existed ever since. The menace was present. The prophets were issuing their warnings. The solution was easy at hand. Instead, the people begged for disaster, and that is what they got. Today the menaces are clear, the prophets are equally clear in their messages, the answer is present, but the reaction of the people is the same. Or maybe worse, for at least the people of Germany answered Hitler's call. The worst that history has ever had to offer will be their lot this time. National Socialists and all students of history are aware that this current business as usual phase is positively incapable of turning a page of history. The break will come to terminate this agonizing, lingering illness, and it will come like thunder. Suddenly. It will be an end to business as usual and a resumption of history. That's volume 11, number 12, December 1982. And that will complete the first third or so of the section 5 of James Mason's Siege. I want to thank you for being with me today, and I'll be back with you again real soon, and we'll carry on with the middle portion of chapter 5.